presentation from the Building Codes and Construction Codes Commission, and we'll have another presentation from the Environment Energy Commission, is that correct?
That's correct, and a third item discussing Senate Bill 265.
So what time constraints would you recommend for each?
Well, it'd take 30 minutes for the first item, and then 15 and 15.
So each commission will get 15 minutes for their presentation?
Thinking is we'd do 30 minutes on building construction codes. Okay. Is that I think that's the meat of the codes, and then 15 for environment and energy, 15 for the state legislation piece.
Good.
So let me start by asking Tim Teddy to come kick us off.
Good evening. First item is an overview of the 2012 building code. It's a project of our Building Codes Commission. We have several members of that commission tonight, and Mr. Malicote, I know, would like to make a few remarks and also be available to answer your questions about their work on this. And also, there will be some time for the Environment and Energy Commission to also add their perspective on aspects of the building code. And I'd like to introduce two of my staff who are in the Building and Site Development Division, which works directly with the building code, and they have provided staff support to the commission. Shane Creech and Phil Teeple, the Building and Site Development Manager and the Building Regulations Supervisor, respectively. So I'd like to just have Mr. Malicote come up then, and if he's comfortable approaching, he
can
start the presentation.
Let me interject one thing. There's an item on tonight's agenda, R-119-13, which places on file for a period of 90 days these changes to the building code. So this starts the process. There's 90 days, and then we take action. So.
Thank you. Fred Malicote, Chairman of the Building Construction Codes Commission. Thanks for allowing us to give our summary of our several months of work. And I know you're aware, but I thought I would reiterate that the Building Construction Codes Commission is made up of 20 members. We have plumbers, electricians, general contractors, small general contractors. The Apartment Association is represented. We have structural engineers, mechanical engineers, architects. So we have a variety of people because the codes are very different, and there's expertise that would allow us to review each aspect of the code. We subdivided into committees and took the people that were experienced in the departments, which we have the International Residential Code, International Building Code, Plumbing Code, International Fire Code, International Mechanical Code, the Property Maintenance Code, International Fuel Gas Code, and the National Electric Code. So it was really not a small task that we were doing. And then each individual committee reviewed the codes, made recommendations, then brought back those recommendations to the entire committee, and they were voted on. Also, public input was asked for and received, as well as the Energy and Environment Commission. They made a presentation, we did to them, and they chatted with us. So Mr. Teeple has already given you a summary of the building code updates. I won't read all of those, but it was done on June 3rd, 2013. There's only one part there that was a little bit different. It says the four differences between the Building Construction Codes Commission and the Environment and Energy recommendations are, and I need to refer to that, the insulation of hot water lines is really no contention at all, but they are in effect adding foundation insulation, which to us promoted more termites than it did help save energy. And then the other differences we were the amount of attic insulation. We're at currently R38, and the energy code wanted to go to 49. Well, there's a payback analysis done by the Building Code Assistance Project, and the wall insulation, or excuse me, I said roof insulation, it had a payback of 47 years, according to those. And most energy items that I've seen and been accustomed to is if it doesn't have a 10-year payback, you don't do it. So the BCC recommended we not go that method. And the other installation was an R19 versus an R15 wall. The R15 is where we are currently. And that payback was never. It actually, if you had to finance it, it gave you a loss of $73 a month. And I don't know anyone that would invest like that and stay in business. Now, are there any questions that you have of me? Because what I was going to do is turn it over to any members of our Building Construction Codes Commission for additional comments.
The installation of hot water pipes is no longer one of the, it's no longer in contention?
No, sir.
Was there a requirement in the codes regarding the CFL lights?
It's another one that isn't in contention. It, it listed on there that it was. It says the amount of high efficacy lamps required. That was one of the first ones that. So
that's
there's
resolved.
Nothing. That, it just says high efficiency lamps. Is
okay.
What you want.
So we're not necessarily requiring these.
That's resolved.
Yes.
So there are three issues remaining.
Correct.
Got it.
The wall, the roof, and the foundation insulation.
And on the hot water pipe insulation, what is the agreed position, to require insulation of hot water pipes or not to?
On hot water recirculating lines, to require the insulation.
Okay, great, thanks.
Now, you'll have members of your commission talk about these three areas.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything else? Okay. Thanks for your time.
Mayor, members of the council, my name is John Page. Been a member of the Energy Codes Commission for somewhere over 20 years. I've been involved in the process of these code reviews for at least that long, and many of those years as the chairman of the committee on this book, which is a residential code. This is a code book, 2012 residential code book. This is what we went through. This book here is a significant changes to that code that we went through. This material here is all material we took in while we were reviewing this code. Very thorough review. We spent 5 months reviewing the code. We spent two of those 5 months on Chapter 11, which is the energy code. And we've come to a very thorough analysis of what we think needs to be done. And interesting enough, the National Association of Home Builders and their analysis came up with almost identically the same thing that we came up with in our recommendations to you guys. I thought that was interesting. We never compared notes or anything. But I want to tell you, or two things I want to tell you is it's a minimum code. We're not setting the maximum. You can do more than that. You can go by the letter to Chapter 11 if you want to. We're not saying you can't. We're saying we're establishing a minimum code, and the houses that we do here in town are at the point where we're at now, are as tight as they need to be. In fact, we're now in bringing in outdoor air to try to help that, because they have gotten too tight. The other thing is sometimes people think that this is about a bunch of experts at a national meeting sitting in a room talking about the codes and setting the codes. And that's not entirely true. A lot of this is market-driven. If a manufacturer, supplier can get their product in the code or get more of their product in the code, then they make a lot of money. So that's something else we need to remember when we're thinking about this. I could talk for a very long time about a lot of subjects on this. I don't want to bore you. My wife sometimes says I'm too windy. But I do have a letter that I want to circulate to you guys on behalf of the Home Builders Association, and we can get that circulated around. You all to look at and digest. Is there any specific questions that you would have? It just so happens that the code that I review, the International Residential Code, seems to have the points of contention that we're talking about.
Well, two of the three differences of opinion have to do with return on investment, right? The attic insulation numbers and the wall insulation numbers. The foundation insulation as a termite threat. Could you have one of your co-commissioners?
I have invited, and he's here tonight, pest control gentleman has a company, Mitch Clevenger, and he's going to come up here and he'll address that. That part of it, Mayor, is not so much of an expense issue, but it's a issue with termites. Now, you can say you can use a termite shield, but termites like moisture and they like darkness. And even with a termite shield, I've been called to houses where they've got damage. And what happens where that termite shield overlaps, they go right up between it and right on up into the wall. It doesn't stop them. I pulled a lot of that foam stuff off, and there's all kinds of termite trails. Now, we don't want to say you can't use it, because I know there are some builders that are involved in loan programs that the loan actually requires that they use it. And we don't want to say, you know, we don't want to bother you to say you can't use it. We're just saying as the minimum you don't need to use it. And I think it's a huge disservice to the homeowners to require that. I see you shaking your head. You must be familiar with that.
Yeah, I just read a termite report today on my house.
And that foam insulation is not a good thing. You know, I can get into some things like, for example, the R49 attic insulation. And we're at R38, R49, you get up to an R49, you have some compaction issues. And I know Rob Huer from Nemo Insulation has said that in order to achieve an R49, you really have to blow an R60. Because by the time the compaction and all of it settles back down to get that R49, you got to blow an R60. If you blow an R49, you're not going to end up with much more than what we got now anyway. So these are things to think about. But anything else? If you would adopt the R20 requirement, which would basically require you to go to a 2x6 wall, or you can do the R13 plus 5, which is an R13 bat, and then the 3/4 inch foam, which is 5.4, which is an application I've been doing for 20 years. I've been building like that for 20 years. But I don't think we should make that a requirement. I think that it drastically changes and increases the cost of a home if we go to an R20 wall. And I don't think that's what we want to do at this time in this town. I think where we're at is where we need to be at. And I know that you all have a report on the barriers to affordable housing, and I think that you could add this to it if you do this. Yes, sir.
Just a question about 2x6 walls. There are ways to adjust 2x6 walls to put them on 20-inch centers, for example, instead of 16-inch centers, or other things like that. Is that care to comment about?
Well, you can put 2-foot center. Is that what you're saying? You put your studs on 2-foot center?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can do that, and the code would allow for that. I don't think you hardly ever see that in this town, but it's something you could do. But, you know, it's more than just about...
That's a mitigation for expense, if expense is one of the considerations.
But I'm getting that. There's more than just the 2x6 material. You've got extension jams for your windows and your doors. All this, it changes everything. It changes the whole way you do things. And when you change in that regard, you have a dramatic increase in cost. Yes, ma'am.
Out of curiosity, you're speaking of cost, and we're talking about increasing the... insulation of our homes, so the more airtight your home is, the more chemicals remain within your home. Was that ever a discussion that you had, as, you know, the more we increase R factor in the homes, that the more we're exposed, you know, to the glues and the toxins and the resins that, you know,
permeate? Well, that could be possible, and the tightness of the house is something we've talked about at the Codes Commission level for several years now, and the fact that we've gotten these homes almost to the point where they're too tight.
Right.
And that's why now you'll see there's an introduction of outside air into the cold air returns to help take care of that.
Okay.
So, yes, that you can. That's correct.
Cost of 2x6 R19 versus 2x4 R14 and R15 in 2,000 square foot houses is much as that?
I think it's on your report. I want to say it was 2,300, was it? It should be on that, all the documentation you've got. It's all in there. 2,300.
Question about your point that these are minimum requirements and builders can voluntarily, provide higher efficiency homes. Do you have any information about how often that currently happens with the existing codes, which are presumably also minimum standards?
I can speak for myself.
Yeah.
It's happened for me for 20 years.
Uh-huh.
And I think it happens quite a bit. Above. Do I have the actual numbers? No.
But it does happen.
I do not have the actual numbers.
And
but I think you would find that more than not, it's done more.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. And with custom homes, people have a choice to up the insulation value.
Absolutely.
I did that 1977, 2x6, so anybody can do that.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Have I bored you enough?
No, very good, John.
No, not yet.
Mitch Clevenger, he'd come up and talk about that, the foam insulation. From a professional standpoint.
Mr. Mayor, Council, forgive me, I'm not a public speaker. Mitch Clevenger is my name. I own Bugs Ferris Pest Management. I've been in this industry for 25 years, right here in Columbia, mostly central Missouri. I'm an associate certified entomologist and have quite a bit of experience with termite control and termite work. I'm here, I guess, to speak of the evils of foam over the foundation. It definitely is a way for termites to enter into the home undetected. You can't see them. They just love to go up the middle of that foam. You won't know they're there until you see damage inside the home or you tear out a wall or something like that. Is there any specific question that anybody might have?
Talk about termite shields. Doesn't that allow?
Yeah, termite
doesn't
shields.
That provide evidence that there's been termite infiltration?
Well, on the foam insulation, usually what's considered a termite shield. To get a proper termite shield, you have your foundation. You need to have a piece of metal or something over the top of that, and it needs to come out and then drop down at about a 45-degree angle, some type of angle. The idea is that the termites come up the wall, they hit that metal, and then they might try to tunnel around it, but they can't make that little knife blade bend, and that's your shield. What happens in most cases, mulch is added around the house, dirt's added around the house. It goes up over the top of that shield. Now it's no shield at all. You know, they just skirt that and go around it. Or, you know, somebody will come along and hammer it down flat against the foundation because, you know, they don't like that sticking out. And again, termites can build right over that. I see very few of those that are terribly successful because of that.
Probably don't see anything that's successful.
Well, a good termite treatment will help.
Yeah, regardless of the termite shield or not, I mean, if the homeowner piles up dirt so that the termites have access to the rest of the house, it's not going to make any difference whether you have a shield or not, right?
Exactly, yeah. Right. Anytime you have dirt above the foundation line, you know, where you're siding brick, and brick is not a deterrent for termites. They don't eat it, but they can certainly go through the expansion joints and the mortar joints and little cracks and things. It doesn't take much for a termite to get in.
What I was suggesting was that a termite shield is better than nothing if, in fact, the homeowner pays some attention to how these things are supposed to
right.
work.
It's better than nothing yeah. if it's installed right and then maintained correctly. But the foam itself, my opinion, is a very bad idea. in most cases, when I find it on a house, I actually recommend that they cut it off so you can see that foundation. If you can see the foundation, you can see a termite tube and detect that problem a lot easier, you know, than waiting to see, you know, mud specks in the sheetrock or your paint kind of flakes off and then you have a little bit of damage.
Any other questions? Thank you.
You're welcome.
Clevenger. Mr. Page, anybody else? Shall we move on? Any more questions from council of the commission? Energy Environment Commission?
Well, let's move on to the Energy Environment Commission. Environment and Energy. Pardon me. Did I say it backwards?
I say it backwards sometimes, too.
Got a better ring to it.
I was told that my slides are on the computer.
I've got them here. Uh-huh. Here it is.
My name is Ken Kroll, and I'm a member of the Environment and Energy Commission. Our chairman was not able to make it. He's out of town on business. And basically, our scope of the code review was the energy section. So we did spend several months on that and had discussions with the BCCC. Basically, it came down to three areas that we couldn't reach a consensus. So those will be the three things I'm going to talk about. And I'm actually going to talk a little bit more on the cost and benefit side. I do have a little bit of information on actually the benefits to the environment. But I'm a builder, so I understand cost issues. So without further ado.
I'll be your Vanna.
Ah, thank you. Okay, let's go to the next slide. We already have sent a letter that back in April that kind of outlined our positions. And there were a couple other things that were in play then, but they've been resolved. So we're just going to stick to attic insulation, wood frame wall insulation, and slab on grade perimeter insulation. So if we go to the next slide. We used the 2,000 square foot both ranch and walkout. And these are the assumptions for that size house. You essentially have around 187 linear feet to get that square footage. On a slab house, it'd be all wood frame. Perimeter would be the same. If you use a 9-foot wall, it'd be 1,683 square feet of wall insulation. The ranch walkout, you have walls that are across the walkout portion. Also, usually you have concrete walls that, you know, stagger down. So the assumptions made there were 280 linear feet of 9-foot wood frame exterior wall, 80 linear feet of on-grade slab. We're talking only about the slab that's on the walkout, not the basement walls. And if you take the 280 times the 9 foot, again, you get 2,520 square foot. The rain assumptions were based upon getting current quotes. Go to the next slide. I chose wall-blown cellulose insulation because I have a bias toward that. But I think probably the incremental cost per square foot between a 2x4 and a 2x6 would probably be not much different on that. So it's 10 cents on blown cellulose. And to go from a 49 to a 38, it's 25 cents a square foot. The additional framing material costs for 2x6 versus 2x4 is 363. Your foam cost for rigid R10 is 304, a linear, it's 173 square foot, 2 foot deep, $3. 150 to install it. For a termite barrier, as I have done in the county, insulated slab, basically I used a trim coil. Went down, you know, to where it'd be exposed, maybe for protection, to protect the foam. And then I went flat underneath the seal, you know, so if termites did burrow underneath, they'd have to go through the aluminum to get into the house. Pretty expensive process. I know that there are other options out there. Probably not certain they're going to be as effective for termite. And, you know, if you cover up your foundation, doesn't matter what you have. Doesn't matter if there's foam there or not. I mean, if you cover up the concrete, you can't see the tunnels. And if you're lucky. Anyway, those are the cost assumptions. So go to the next slide. You know, and I gave you that, so if you want to kind of check the math, you can go ahead and do that. But basically, on a 2,000-square-foot house, the attic insulation costs $500 more. The wall insulation with the extra framing and insulation would be $847. And the slab perimeter would be $1,800. And, it, you know, it's actually costing more to deal with the termite issue than to insulate it with the approach that I've taken, because I know it's been accepted by a county inspection. That's a total of $3,000 for building the walkout. Walkout's actually a little bit less, maybe because you have less slab insulation. Attic's the same because 2,000 square foot, same size attic. Got a little bit more wood frame, so that's higher, 1,268. Your slab perimeter is 781 total, so about $2,500. One of the things that, you know, we kind of reached a compromise on, I think, in our discussions between the two commissions, go to the next slide, was whether or not third-party testing should actually be required. The code requires it, okay? And I think we ended up being pretty comfortable, hopefully, on both commissions, that, at least on the EEC, that as long as an inspector had the right to require performance testing, blower door, or duct leakage, if there was anything in the rough inspections that he did not like, that we thought that allowing visual inspection at rough, it would be reasonable. I did do a cost-benefit analysis with and without. Basically you have two ways to calculate payback. You can do, you know, basically your simple payback, which is here's how much it costs, here's how much I save per year, and how long does it take? And there is a payback on those lines. Generally, not as fast as I would like. But if you do life cycle cash flow analysis where you bill it to the mortgage, then the numbers, I think, are quite a bit different. And so that's the analysis that we did. And basically, I used 4, 5, and 6% 30-year mortgage. If you fold that 3176 into the mortgage, the additional annual cost is those numbers there, 180, 2205, 228. We got some data from the Midwest Energy Efficiency Alliance on annual savings for this area, because they have models that can take the holistic approach of the house. You know, it's beyond my ability to do that. But they're I think, fairly accepted models. And for a on-grade slab house, 2,000 square foot, the utility savings is $294. So basically, the homeowner benefits slightly, and the environment definitely benefits. Go to the next slide. If we take that same slab house, throw in the extra $600, the numbers, of course, go up as far as the annual cost that's amortized by those numbers. But you still, the homeowner still comes out somewhat ahead. And again, based upon the modeling computer programs from MEEA, use about 34 million BTUs. And based upon the number of starts we had for single and two-family residential permits last year in Columbia, you see that translates to about 27 million BTU. And that's just 1 year. Now, a house should last 75 to 100 years anyway. You know, so those savings and energy reduction accrues for that length of time. We'll run very briefly through the walkout. I mean, it's the same approach. And there are actually less savings with a walkout. And the reason for that is the slab insulation accounts for almost half of the utility savings. So it's a little bit over half of the cost, but it's almost half of the savings. So it's a significant player if we're trying to reduce energy consumption, make homes more energy efficient. And again, you can see without the third-party testing, the homeowner's fairly safely ahead. And we're not talking huge dollars for individual homeowner. We are talking, pretty deep, significant benefit over time to the environment. And the homeowner's not out if it's folded into the mortgage. If we fold in the third-party cost, then at 6% basically becomes break-even. So let's go to the next slide. And I've already kind of hit on this. You know, there's also ways to crunch numbers, also ways to figure payback. But, you know, we're talking about a facility that's going to last a long time. It's financed by mortgages. If you fold these costs into the mortgage, I think that's a valid way to look at the cost-benefit relationship. I think it's better than just simple payback. The other thing I just want to point out, I just pulled some numbers from the Department of Energy, which does use life cycle as well, but they figured on average for Zone 4, which is a lot of states besides not just the state of Missouri, but they have come up with an average cost for these changes of $2,000 for a larger home. Again, I got recent bids for this analysis. I mean, that's all within the last 2 weeks. I went with a termite system that I know has been accepted by the county. And it's a lot worse than what the Department of Energy says it should be. So I have a lot of confidence, I think, in the analysis that we put forth here as far as the cost and benefit. Just a few closing. Sorry.
I don't know if there's a closing slide.
Yeah, okay, final thoughts. Sorry, not closing thoughts. The EEC, our charter is to be an advocate for the environment. We take that seriously, but we're not naive enough to think that, hey, we need to take care of the environment to hell with the cost. So we do try to be realistic. But clearly, the adopting the code will give us more energy efficient homes across the board as a minimum. A lot of builders already do this and even more. That does raise the minimum standard, which we think is a good thing because we think it's cost effective. You get better quality home, and actually, making them tight does not make a home less healthy. You have to bring in the outdoor air. But that actually gets more, you can program your air exchanges and actually have a healthier environment as a result. I didn't look at anything that's not widely available and been used in the past. So we're not advocating unproven technology or techniques. And I've already made reference to this, but, once you build a home, it is what it is. You can blow some more attic insulation. Probably not going to do much to the wall. You're not going to do much to the foundation. Pretty much is what it is from an energy standpoint. Of course, you can always upgrade appliances, as they were. But, we're talking about something that has an impact not just in the first year, but for a lot of years. And the other thing, kind of the flip side of that is, the city has programs, Boone Electric, a lot of the co-ops have programs to try to get upgrades to existing homes, and those are good programs, but it's a lot more cost effective to build it in the first time. And we're talking about between 1-2% to the cost of a home, but if you look at the average cost per square foot for this area, we're talking about neutralizing that up cost really by a relatively insignificant decrease in from our perspective, we don't think that it negatively impacts affordability, at least not significantly. Any questions?
I think this is an interesting analysis, and it's interesting that we're looking at this in a 4% mortgage environment where the payoff is going to be different than a 6% mortgage environment. And I'm interested in this idea of the life cycle analysis. And I wonder if there's a way to approach the codes. See, there's two cases. One is a person's building their own home and they have a choice. another is where one person's building a home and another person's renting a home and paying the utility bill. So the person who's paying this cost isn't the person who's paying the utility bill. And I'm wondering if there's been a discussion of how you would approach that to maybe treat rentals a little bit differently, maybe requiring a higher minimum in only a rental or something that's likely to be a rental, or is that just too complicated to get at?
Well, actually, you know, we didn't look at whether it's going to be owner-occupied or rental, to answer the question specifically. If you were to look at it from those two perspectives, you know, you could almost, I mean, from an owner standpoint or investor standpoint, you could kind of argue that, hey, you know, raising the minimum on a rental house kind of works against me because I still have to pretty much compete on price per square foot with a rental that doesn't have these energy efficiency features.
I see what you're saying. In terms of the cost to build and enter the rental market, where there are already existing rental properties.
Right. Yeah, and that's always going to be the case. You know, so I think you know, I'm not certain I have the confidence that a rental property would garner a higher rent just because it's more energy efficient. It should, but I don't know that the public has that education at this point. So if you were asking, does it make sense to maybe raise the standard for rentals but not for...
Well, and see, like we know with multifamily that it's going to be rental. We don't know with a single family house whether, you know, you might be able to know as a builder, you're building a rental.
For the first owner, yeah.
You know, from the legal standpoint, you can't really say this is going to be a rental, this is going to be a owner occupied.
And it very likely could change over 75 or 100 years, too, from owner occupied.
That's quite true as standards change.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about doing that type of analysis. I mean, the commission hadn't. I think it would be hard to try to do an ordinance though that to try to differentiate if that was your question. Mm-hmm. But you guys know about ordinances better than I.
Yeah. I guess I was just interested in the extent of your conversations, if any, on that topic.
No, we didn't look at it from
that's just something I hear a lot about. Summer.
Yeah. I mean our focus still primarily was environmental and
Understood. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, just one question. It's kind of an aside. I'm assuming that there's kind of a range here, and then the range is from adopting the 2013 International Building Codes, which is the most efficient and the most expensive, all the way back down to the Building Codes Commission, which is the least efficient and least expensive, and then the EEC is somewhere in between because of the differences of opinion that you have with the BCCC. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think, you know, overall, as you can tell, kind of, from, you know, that we advocate that we do slab insulation in the R 13.5 or R19 for the wall in the R45 attic, we're probably closer to adopting most of the 2012 energy code than not. I mean, these are you know, three pretty big pieces.
Yeah, I guess that's what I meant. 2012 is 2013 now, but it's a 2012
code. Yeah, I knew
what you meant. Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you very much. Let me just say how much I and I'm sure my fellow council members appreciate the work you go through. When I see the stack of detail that Mr. Page brings up, obviously that's beyond our scope to understand. We'd never get through it. We wouldn't understand it anyway. So we value everything that all the time, the hours you guys put into this. It's city is better because of all this. Now tonight, it's not our job tonight, as I understand, to arbitrate. It doesn't sound like there's a lot of difference here. But our job tonight is basically to put on notice that these are the recommendations, that there are some differences. We're putting it on notice, and we'll give members of the public an opportunity to speak, but we won't be changing any of the recommendations tonight. We'll merely be announcing it. It'll be on record. And debate among council will be in 90 days or 3 months. Is that correct? That process correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Can I just make one comment? Yeah. And just in appreciation as well. I know that I served as the chair of the Environment and Energy Commission, And I know that there's been tremendous cooperation over the years between the EEC and the BCCC, and that has continued, and that needs to continue. That's a good thing. There are always differences of opinion. I think there always will be differences of opinion. But I'm glad to see that that the two groups have interacted to the extent that they have, and obviously have produced a product that's quality product for both of those commissions, and I very much appreciate it.
Thank you all very much. We'll move to the last item.
I'll ask Tony Messina to come forward to overview a request we received to weigh in on state legislation, Senate Bill 265 in specific, and the request is to ask the governor to veto that bill. Tony, would you give us the overview, please?
Okay. I'm looking at some material that's on the legislative site, bill summary. Briefly, the bill would prohibit the state of Missouri and all political subdivisions from adopting or implementing policy recommendations that infringe or restrict private property rights without due process, as may be required by Agenda 21. The state and political subdivisions are also prohibited from entering into agreements with or spending any sum of money for organizations that are involved in promoting some of the ideas and the strategies outlined in Agenda 21. I looked at that document briefly, about 350 pages, as it was adopted in 1992, and what I thought I saw was a whole raft of recommendations that nations, states, cities, villages could take to kind of balance the priorities of economic development and energy and environmental issues. I even saw some references to strategies that should be community-specific, things that should not violate private property rights. Nevertheless, that seems to be the concern of the people who have supported this bill, that essentially these are things that political subdivisions do can be traceable to Agenda 21, that they're not based on laws or ordinances that were enacted at the local level, and that they are connected to some international policies over which voters have no control. Now, I'm sorry to say that there was very little opposition expressed to this legislation during the session. I believe a lot of folks thought someone was trying to send a message, it would get a hearing, and perhaps would not get any further. Nevertheless, the bill did pass in both the House and the Senate with majorities that appeared to be veto-proof. However, there are some political subdivisions, including the city of Kansas City, that are asking the governor to veto this bill because they believe it's an infringement on your local government self-determination. And indeed, when we think about it, how would that affect the voter-mandated requirements for renewable resources? How would that affect what you're trying to do with the building codes? Barbara Buffalo might have another couple comments on that.
Right. Well, Kansas City was worried about it because they use some standards that could be, you know, in a weird spectrum of things linked back to the UN's non-binding resolution of Agenda 21. So, like, they do their greenhouse gas emissions protocol using an ICLEI model, and this is a national standard for doing greenhouse gas emissions. And we also, because we signed the mayor's climate protection in 2006, we use the same protocol because that's what we did. Now, we're not a member of ICLEI anymore. We just still use their protocol because it's the standard. But we don't actually participate in any of their programs or any of their members. But that's one of our concerns is, like, what happens if I continue using this protocol that's could be linked back to the, you know, we wonder, like, A, what's going to happen with this and whether or not there's any binding. I don't know. It just seemed like a weird impact for us.
So at the end of the day, there's a lot of questions that the bill brings up that don't have easy answers. On its face, it seems to outlaw membership in ICLEI and in any sort of energy efficiency measures that you might take or companies you might contract with that are in that business that are also working for the UN or for other organizations that are sponsored by the UN. So I think the critics of this bill would say they're stunned that it passed. They didn't take it seriously because of all of the books that have come out recently, including Glenn Beck's about Agenda 21, which is a fiction book and is a story about, well, the first line is, "They took my mother away today," and people dressed in black. And it sort of outlines a fairly sort of idealized negative future state based on the UN's, again, non-binding guidelines for carbon emission reduction. So the connection seems hard to understand at face value. This bill, you know, it didn't seem to have any enforcement tools related to it either. So it seems, again, to be a restriction on local government purchasing, local government decision making, without any real teeth. So it's, from our perspective, not a good bill in that regard. So we wanted to give you the opportunity to decide if you wanted to communicate with the governor about this or not. Questions?
Well, first of all, it's a 350-page bill. And I don't understand a lot of what you guys said. So I'm not in a position to analyze this. I would love to hear from our local legislators. You know, we have both parties representing our area. And
I'm sorry to confuse you. The Agenda 20 or Agenda 21 is a 350-page document.
Not the bill.
The bill is just 3 pages. And our legislators, most of our delegation supported this bill.
I think what the mayor's saying, though, is it's making reference to a 350-page document that I'm going to say none of us have read.
Well,
I've heard of it, but I haven't.
But I haven't. So the bill passed. All of our legislators voted for it.
Most of them.
Who voted for it and who didn't?
Senator Schaefer voted for it in the House, and Representatives Jones.
Schaefer's in the Senate.
You're right.
Senate.
Representatives Rowden, Jones, and Wright voted for it in the House.
And Kelly?
Kelly and Weber were absent with leave that day.
Did not vote?
They did not vote.
Well, you know, Carl, you understand this issue a lot better than we do, and you may have a recommendation about it. I guess I'm a little uncertain about proceeding down this road when none of us have studied this issue.
What's the history of Columbia City Council taking this kind of action? Has it ever happened before?
Historically, the City Council has been reluctant to get involved in political issues. On the other hand, we just did recently sign something on a local level with the university in terms of the museum and so on. And there has been, I mean, people have been on both sides of this as to whether or not the City Council ought to get involved in this in more political matters.
Well, you know, you can see how the last thing we need is a council debate on gun control or abortion. I mean, we've got enough work to do, things that we have control over. This may be one of those. Would you be willing to send out a report to the other council members of your analysis of this?
Oh, sure, sure. I tend to agree with Ms. Messina about her analysis of how this came down with ICLEI and all the rest of it. But sure, I'd be happy to do that.
Well, I'd like to know why our legislators voted for it.
Well, most of it is long party line. Even though this is a nonpartisan body, most of it is long party lines.
Yeah. There's a level of hysteria and fear that's perpetrated by primarily right-wing radio and novels, specifically on that. I know delegates who were part of the UNSAID conference and understand that process. I didn't read the whole document when it came out. I read summary documents. There are non-binding resolutions, but then there's this kind of jackbooted thug rhetoric that's whipped up hysteria in the legislators responding to that. And if I would say it's none of our business, they do all lots of things that I consider foolish, and I just mind my own business, except that this very much gets into our, you know, it applies to us too, and who we can associate with, who the city can make agreements with. And I think we should take a stand if we want to do some more work on it before we do.
Right, and I can reply to that. Kansas City chose for theirs, I talked to the environmental officer there, and their, the way that they wrote their resolution was not as a pro the 349 page. It was not pro Agenda 21 resolution. It was more of a opposing the unreasonable, unnecessary restraint of the city's contracting and policy powers that have an unknown effect on them. That's where they had problems. It wasn't necessarily with this issue. It was the local control issue.
Right.
I still would like to see a written analysis. Mm-hmm. And Carl, if you want to contribute to that, yeah. I'd appreciate it.
Michael. Sure.
Now, I have a question. Our lobbyist will work with the legislature. Will our lobbyist also communicate our opinions to the government or to the governor?
That would be our responsibility.
Okay. Oh, I see. And that's why that's the difference. And I don't know if there's any been any opinion yet on the legality of this bill. You know, let's just say the governor doesn't veto it. Is it, do we just wait for a court challenge?
That's kind of a good question on that.
Yeah. And that was our, Mike, you had that question of like, does that mean somebody's going to come and arrest me? If I don't know. It doesn't, it's not clear.
No, maybe we should wait for, if Carl could do some analysis for us and you could maybe get us some answers to these questions. Maybe our trusty attorney would want to render an opinion on the legality.
I expect we can get an opinion. So, yes, at the bottom line, I would say the bill as written does absolutely constrain your decision-making powers in ways that never the state never has before. At the same time, there doesn't appear to be any bad outcomes to that. So there's no penalties that were outlined. So it just forbids any interaction. Yeah. So it's hard to understand exactly what it means, quite honestly, the way it's written. And the list of businesses we would not be able to contract with is significantly large. But I think that's the analysis we should do and come back to you with. That's what I'm hearing.
All right. Can we take a little break and try to start promptly at 7?
Right.